I'm John Verner, host of the Cult of Christianity podcast. I explore the hard, unpopular truths about Christianity in the modern world. Join me as my guests and I discuss the nuances and subtle problems of evangelicalism in America. Cult survivors, religious experts, pastors, Christians, and everyone in between are allowed to express their views freely. But the Cult of Christianity podcast focuses on discerning the truth from lies, examining the root causes of these problems, and offering solutions. You can go to thecultofchristianity.com or find the Cult of Christianity wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this week's mini-series on the Cult Vault podcast. I'm your speaker, Casey, and before we get started, a big warm welcome to Kay, newest patron and supporter of the podcast. Thank you so much for choosing the Cult Vault. I hope that you enjoy the content. Also, if any of the listeners use Reddit and you are interested in the subject of cults, there is a subreddit that I'm a part of called r/cultpodcasts. Come and say hi and check out the content there. This installment focuses on spiritual abuse and religious trauma with senior pastor Ken Garrett. Ken and his family suffered heavily at the hands of an abusive church, recognizing years later that they were subjected to cult-like methods and coercive control. In this series, Ken talks about what this coercive control looked like, how others can spot it, and how we can each heal and, in some cases, hold on to our faith. When I asked Ken if he could provide me with some bullet point information on what spiritual abuse looked like, he responded with this. You thought you'd found a great church, but instead of freedom and joy, you found rules and depression. You thought you'd found a great church, but instead of humble leaders, you found arrogant, controlling bullies. You thought you'd found a great church, but instead of forgiveness and hope, you found guilt and shame. You thought you'd found a great church, but instead of healing from spiritual wounds, you found new assaults on your soul. You thought you'd found a great church, but instead of a place to freely support, you found a place that extracted dear and precious things from you. Spiritual abuse may include things like increasing unhealthy influence over day-to-day activities and behavior of members, disconnection and cutting off from non-church family and friends, defensiveness when challenged about beliefs, leaders, and policies of the church, a culture of fear, rewards, and emotional punishments within the church, shunning, loss of church friendships when a member leaves the church, severe emotional trauma, depression and anxiety in members who leave the church or are expelled by leaders. Ken is the author of a wonderful book on his experiences titled In the House of Friends, Understanding and Healing from Spiritual Abuse in Christian Churches. He is also a co-author on a collaborative book titled Wounded Faith. I will link to both of these texts in the episode description. Also, I wanted to note that during our conversation, there were some technical issues where the audio kept dropping in and out, and I've made an effort to tidy up some of this audio, but there are still some disruptions throughout. And during our conversation, Ken quotes the former International Cultic Studies Association president, Michael Langoni, and emailed me later on to let me know that the correct quote is, quote, in an authoritarian environment, you either obey or you lie, end quote. Although what Ken says in our episode does reflect this sentiment exactly. In part one, I ask Ken general questions about life in a high-demand religious group. In part two, we focus on Ken's own experiences in an abusive church setting, with part three looking at escape, recovery, activism, and holding on to faith. If you would like early access to full-length and ad-free episodes, please consider supporting the show at patreon.com/thecultvault from as little as £1 a month or $1.50. And now, here is Ken. So hi, Ken, and welcome to the show. I've been looking forward to this conversation since reading the book Wounded Faith, and I'm honoured to have a whole month of interviewing contributing authors to this book. good self. Would you like to start by introducing yourself to the listeners?
Absolutely. My name is Ken Garrett. I'm born and raised in Portland, Oregon, on the west coast of the United States. And I am a pastor of an urban church in downtown Portland. It's about 148-year-old church, which is very old for us here. I've been there for almost 20 years. And before that, I was a paramedic here in Portland for 20 years. And I'm married to Sharon. We have three adult daughters, five grandchildren. And we still live in the neighborhood where I grew up and close to downtown Portland. And the significant thing, I guess, that brings us together today is that I did spend, Sharon and I spent 12 years in a church that was focused on a lot of very intense aspects of Christianity, was doctrinally sound and all of that, but it was very controlling and abusive. And after a few years after leaving it, it became very clear to me that the most authentic way to refer to it is as a cult. And so we were in a cult for 12 years, which had a profound effect from our experience of life and our thinking and on me moving ahead and completing an education and becoming a pastor of a church. Yeah. So that's me.
It's really fascinating in the way that you still live in the area that you grew up in, and the church that you are a part of is a 148-year-old building, which sounds amazing. A lot of the time we might hear of people moving as far away from environments that have caused them distress as possible, but it feels like here you really dug down and decided that you were going to work through all of the things that happened and make a positive change.
Yes, I think that's a good way to describe it. And also, especially in recovering from our abuse. Oh, and by the way, we live in the same town. I live in the same town I grew up in, but it's a home base for a real love of travel and international travel. So we're gone a lot. But the idea of settling into my neighborhood where I was a child, where I grew up, where my dad grew up, where I was a paramedic and then a pastor now, that had a lot to do, my situation now really has a lot to do with the healing that it brought me to stay rooted into the places that I lived and inhabited before I was involved in the cultic church. So it's almost a form of healing. It is a form of healing to me to walk down streets and sidewalks that, I knew so well in my pre-cult life, if that makes sense. So it's definitely a part of my healing to be rooted into this particular place.
I think that's incredible to hear somebody speak that out loud, because as a first generation member of the church that you're involved in, as we spoke about a little bit before we hit the record button, sometimes a lot of experts in cult recovery might talk about trying to reconcile with your pre-cult identity, and how people can find that really difficult. But that can be one thread that helps somebody move through that deconstruction and healing process. And you've talked about doing that by walking through those childhood streets. Wow, that's amazing.
One of the things that I would do in the years before I left my cult, before Sharon and I left with our kids, was I would, in the wee hours of the night, the early morning hours, I would go back to my old neighborhood, to the neighborhood I live in now, and just walk the streets. And I was a pretty big self-medicator, so I would be chain smoking, walking down the streets, trying to survive the night, basically. And so I probably creeped out a lot of the neighbors around here that saw this guy walking down, up and down their streets. But it brought me a lot of healing. And so it was almost like returning to a homeland for me, to make a 2-mile drive to the neighborhood where I grew up. And just a thought that occurred to me, you know, while you were just saying that, Casey, is that the tragedy or the extreme difficulty of born and raised survivors of religious abuse is that they don't have that pre-cult experience like I had. I could go back to, high school friends, friends that I had cut off when I was in the cult, but I could go back and say, hey, guess what? The last 12 years of my life, I know I have been horrible and I'm sorry. And I just wanted to let you know, you thought I was being a real ass and horrible and all of this, and you're completely and totally right. And my religion drove me to that. I guess maybe not my religion, but how I practiced it, you know, I was glad to be that way. And I'm so sorry. And most of them, of course, just kind of said, well, Kenny, you know, we love you, man. We just missed you and welcome back. And so I had that to go back to, and parents and family and aunts and uncles and sisters who, of course, were concerned about me while I was a real fanatic in this cult. And I had cut them off, too, in many ways, in terms of family traditions and participation. But they were really a part of my recovery team. They just jumped right in like, yeah, you've always been a little crazy, but, you know, we love you and we're just glad you're back and we're going to the beach next week. Let's go. So I had that to go back to, and a very pronounced and sad difficulty of people who grew up in these groups. The abusive churches and abusive cults and things, they don't have a pre-cult life, and therefore they don't have a pre-cult identity. And they grew up in a condition where, as cult children, Michael Langoni is the president of ICSA, and he said this, and it meant a lot to me. Those children had two options growing up. Either tell the truth or lie. And that was the options. And to tell the truth brought horrendous, horrendous consequences to their life. So they became consummate liars. And so you can't build a trustworthy identity when you grow up lying to survive, lying about your feelings, lying about your doubts, lying about what people say to you or do to you or things you don't like, or, you know, just lying. It denies you the opportunity to grow up with a healthy self. And I wish I could speak more to that experience. I'm just learning it myself, but that's a difference. I had something to go back to. I met my wife when she was 15 and I was 17. And we had a pre-cult marriage. It was a very naive young marriage, but it was a pre-cult relationship with one another. And that pre-cult experience gave us a very solid kind of a rock in the rapids to jump onto and find some stability. And so I'm very fortunate in that regard, and I'm just starting to understand the way that is denied to, like, my children or children that have grown up in those groups.
And you mentioned that Sharon and yourself, you were together before you joined your church for 12 years. Yes. So did you find it together, or was it something that one of you found first and the two of you ended up in together?
I found it first, but we were both primed for it. I'd been away in the military for 3 years, and Sharon and I were married about halfway through my enlistment, and we lived in North Carolina and then in California. So we were kind of homeless in terms of belonging in a neighborhood. So we always intended to go back to Portland, but we really wanted to find, and this is really true of most cultists and people that join these groups. We really wanted to find a church that would take Christianity, what we called seriously, that was serious in its commitment, that got down to business, that really lived for the Lord, that was doing, we would say, Christianity, you know, 7 days a week. And we wanted a depth of community experience. We wanted to share life. I mean, you can tell I'm just throwing out all of these phrases that kind of build on an ethos of community and a holistic experience of community and togetherness with other people. We wanted to raise our children with like-minded people, and by like-minded, I mean, we were kind of child of the 60s, but a little younger than that. But we wanted that communal feel of real love and friendliness with those around us and all of that. And we wanted it in a Christian setting. And so we explored different Christian community situations and intentional living things. And we were recruited into our cult when I was getting off duty one morning as a paramedic, and I had my Bible sitting out on a table in the kitchen of our quarters. And a woman came in who was going to relieve me on my shift. And she said, "Oh, are you a Christian?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And she said, "There's that Bible sitting right there." And she said, "Oh," and then she made some small talk, but she got right to the issue of, do you go to church? And it was like, we're looking for a church. And that is like, in that kind of a conversation, to say that is like swinging the door, you know, wide open and just saying, "Here I am, I'm looking for a church." And for a cult recruiter, those words are just like, "Oh my goodness, this is going to get my week's quota right now. I can actually go to a movie this week. You know, I'm gonna get this guy." So I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Well, what are you looking for in a church?" And we're just really getting to it, right? Okay, what are you looking for in a church? And I said, "Well, I'm looking for a church that's kind of small, and maybe meets in a home instead of a big building, and really has a focus on discipleship. I really want help in my spiritual life." And I didn't tell her this, but I really had hoped I would become a pastor someday. And I said that, and what that was kind of a dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. It was like, what more, you know? What more would I need to hear from this guy? So she, as a good cultist herself, she said, "I happen to have exactly that. We meet in a house out in Southeast Portland. We focus on disciple making, where we mentor, or we have older Christians mentoring us to become more, and we're serious. We meet Sunday and Wednesday, and we pray, and we do all of this stuff. Oh, and by the way, our pastor, he's a veteran himself. You'll feel right at home, Ken." And so she recruited me lock, stock, and barrel right into it. And I was like a fish with a hook deep set, you know. She was just reeling me in. And Sharon and I visited the church, and I wrote about it in my book, our first visit, which was challenging would be the kindest word to say about it, but it really triggered my desire for a hard Christianity. I think maybe that would make my transition out of the military seem more normal to me. So I wanted the structure and the command and a hard, you know, kind of a thing with younger families and whatnot. And that's what recruited us into this church. And by the way, my recruiter left when I did too, or within a couple of months, and we're buddies, and we're, you know, so, I mean, it's not, when you're in a group like that, you don't become an evil person. When you recruit people into the group, you feel that you are just sharing, man, you are just sharing the best thing that ever happened to you, and you want to spread it. And At least that's the best part of recruiting. You might be dogged into it, but nonetheless, nothing bad about her. She was just doing what you do. And some cult experts call that becoming deployable. You are deployable into the culture as a cult representative to bring people into the cult. So she was just doing her thing. And we're best buddies now. I mean, we have been for many years, and we joke about it now. And I always remind her that actually my life was goofed up totally by her, by recruiting me into a cult. And she really appreciates hearing that whenever we get together.
Just another quick reminder that you this cult for 12 years. Oh yeah, thanks for the thanks for the reminder. Appreciate that, Ken. Keeping me humble. I think what we've heard previously on some of these episodes is that when individuals do become deployable, they are often going out to put onto unsuspecting individuals what put onto them. And that full cycle of seeing somebody being either converted or introduced or whatever number of words you would use for the initial introduction into a group goes full circle when that person goes out and uses exactly the same conversation that they had with their recruiter on somebody else that they then bring to the group. To me, is actually quite fascinating, I think.
Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. And that's exactly what I became. I was deployable and I became a recruiter myself for the church.
Wow. And often when people find these new groups that they become a part of, there's the love bombing aspect that goes into ensuring people, they are making the right decision or on the right path with the group that they're becoming integrated with. But there's also a sense of utopia. Yeah, that it's idyllic, that it's
yes,
you know, creating something quite beautiful. Is that the experience that you and you feel Sharon had when you first joined this group?
Absolutely, Casey. We were treated with respect and interest by people who were older than us, and by that I mean like 10 years older. We weren't older people. I was 24, so the people in their mid 30s that were like really big people to me, they treated me with interest, respect. Let's go to coffee, let's have breakfast, and let's go hiking. And so to be treated with that kind of friendliness by people who are socially and culturally at a different level and stage than you was pretty heady stuff for me and for Sharon. And there were other young families with children. We were pregnant with our first when we joined. And there were others in that part of life, too, that could share with each other. And it wasn't that all of the friendships or sharing were inauthentic, hypocritical, weird, creepy things. They were great times of hanging with friends. And I mean, there was nothing better going on in our lives. It's that it was based on a real crumbly foundation of the church. So eventually it fell apart as we grew older and real life started hitting us. But the love bombing, the purpose of the love bombing is to attract people to the church. But more than that, it's to then begin to meet so many important emotional needs in the person's life with the subtle encouragement to close off those needs being met elsewhere. Okay, so you're being love bombed with an underlying the underlying argument of why would you go anywhere else for this? Why go home and spend Thanksgiving or Christmas with your family when we who really love you for who you are, because you've probably confessed a lot of dirty sins by then too. You know, we love you for who you really are. You know what that means. Why would you want to continue hanging with your old friends at, you know, at the football game or at the bar? I guess it would be a pub for you, which is fun and I love it. But, you know, rather than stay with that thing, why would you want to when we're meeting your needs so great and you get Jesus too? And so within a short amount of time, really a few months, you have begun to cut yourself off from other social connections and hobbies and interests and basically identifiers of your personality. You've kind of cut yourself off from that and identified yourself in the place where you're getting a tremendous emotional blast that is life-changing. You're driving home buzzing after these meetings and you're finally loved. You finally have a brother. You finally have a sister. You finally have a mom and a, you know, whatever you're thinking you want. So that continues until you have burnt those bridges. And then comes the reward punishment cycles of membership. You get the love bombing experience, or at least an experience of feeling accepted, as long as you perform in these tasks or these expectations. And when you don't, the thing that brought you in, the love bombing attributes, is immediately withdrawn from your experience. You don't have your brothers and your sisters and your friends and your childcare and the things that you love. You don't have it because you have failed the church's expectations. And that push and pull of reward and punishment, which can take place even on an hourly basis, it trains you to prefer to stay emotionally protected, even at the expense of truth, of you being a real person, of you still playing the guitar or still going to the pub or still doing the things you did, even at the expense of the things that many of them made you who you are, you obey and fit into the new environment in order to continue getting that provision and supply of love. And you begin to experience the little jabs of punishment, of withdrawal. You don't want that. So the love bombing has stopped. And now you are a conditioned and being conditioned member of a cult. So now the work begins to make you deployable to go love bomb others into the cult. That makes sense?
Perfect, perfect sense. I think that's one of the most I've heard that summarized, and you've even explained there how that pre-identity was stripped away and replaced with what was beneficial for either the path or the teachings of this specific church. Would you say that it was all for the pastor's benefit, or was your church part of an umbrella of Christianity that functions in the same way across maybe different parts of the country or the world?
Mm-hmm. We were not a part of any organization or denomination. So we were solely and completely independent, which is a phenomena, especially in the United States, because we have just a little bit of a real insistence on being independent. You know, I mean, everybody wants to do what they want to do. And so we, many, many, many independent churches. So we were independent of any authority outside of our church. So I would say, as the years go on, I believe that it was in service of our narcissistic pastor. Now I say that not suggesting that there wasn't anything good that was happening or that I didn't learn a lot. And I don't even believe that he consciously went through every hour of the day thinking, oh, how am I going to ruin these people's lives and take their money and their women and their cars? How am I going to get it? You know, I think in his better, desperate moments, he honestly hoped that he was doing something that was redeemable, and that somehow, despite himself, God was somehow going to accept his efforts. And maybe if his efforts were even successful enough, God would give him a pass at the brutal and more controlling aspects that came to mark his ministry, including his, drugs and womanizing and all kinds of crud, you know, that really happened, I think, in all of his life. But I think all of that being said, the whole church became a narcissistic supply system for him, with each person providing their own particular flavor of need meeting to him. Yeah.
This particular individual was a veteran himself, and I've done a few episodes based on the U.S. Armed Forces, looking at the Army and the Marine Corps. Do you think that he has used the structures of being involved in that high demand control group and implemented them into the church to replicate it, but perhaps in a destructive way?
Mm-hmm. The thing about the armed forces is, although they are certainly, I guess any armed force has to be controlling and structured, nonetheless, there are these opportunities of advancement that occur, and the end of enlistment that occurs, and even the ways to get out of it if you don't like it that occur. So it depends on that kind of authenticity to continue to survive. And or it should anyway. And so I don't think he implemented that aside from his desires to be, you know, Ike Eisenhower over his church, basically. I don't think that as much as he implemented the model of a parachurch organization called the Navigators. Have you heard of them?
No.
Okay. The Navigators. Now, I want to preface what I'm saying by pointing out that they are a wonderful ministry, and they even have faced some of their controlling tendencies and repented of them. And they're just a great Bible-based kind of a thing now. I think they're still in existence. But anyway, the Navigators were started in the 1940s, I believe, by a gentleman named Dawson Trotman. And his main focus was discipling servicemen on especially naval bases, West Coast naval bases, with tons of scripture memory, obedience to him, the discipler, church attendance, evangelizing constantly. And they just kind of became Jesus people in the Navy bases. And they attracted a lot of soldiers and sailors to them. And they did a lot of wonderful, wonderful things. But they were absolutely authoritarian. And then along that time comes Billy Graham, who has a crusade a system and structure that he starts doing across America after the war. And he is wildly successful. He even gets the president to pray with him. I mean, he's just, you know, he's really something. He's a young guy, good looking, and he's got a team and all of that. Well, he invites Dawson Trotman to become his partner with these crusades at discipling the people who come forward to become Christians. For the most part, it works great. And it was a nice structure to give for people who became Christians to kind of get an idea of, okay, here's some verses I can memorize. Here's a Bible. Here's where I might start reading it. Here's what Christianity is all about. No big deal. There. But the Navigator system also depended on these soldiers and sailors living together in a house.
Okay.
For training, right? On base or right off base. Now you can imagine what that would be like, right? A house of 10 sailors living together, and they're all getting along, but they're really still in the military when they go home in that kind of a situation. Our pastor was in one of those homes in the late 1960s or early 70s. And that had a profound impact on him. He was a brand new Christian, and he lived in a navigator home in an army base in Texas. Fast forward 10 years, now he's starting a church in Portland, and his vision is to have a navigator model discipleship home only with wives and children, families in the household instead of just soldiers. What could go wrong? A lot.
That kind of setup kind of starts to feel a little bit like the Children of God, you know, piles and piles of people living in houses and communes, you know, kind of away from the outside world. I don't know what could go wrong.
Yeah, that is precisely what it became. If you're familiar with Children of God, that it became that sort of an environment. And so Sharon and I ended up moving into, when we made the move as a ministry to become more communal, we sold our house and moved into a house in the neighborhood of the church. And I think we had a dozen or so houses in this neighborhood. We were going to, you know, really bless this neighborhood. Yeah, well, they practically showed up with pitchforks. They didn't want us in their neighborhood. They didn't want to be taken over. And they could figure out their own way to church if they wanted to go to church, you know. And really, it was control. You know, we would be closer in, more controlled, and also find our emotional needs in each other instead of whatever other sources. And financially, more money would flow into the church just through, I don't know, increasing commitment or something. Well, the next step was for us to occupy or move into several large homes in a nicer neighborhood nearby. And we lived communally, renting bedrooms and rooms and sections of houses. So it did evolve to families sharing large homes. So that long story, just kind of, I tell that to say that's where I think it came from, way back in the Navigator ministry and the impact it had on our narcissistic pastor. I think it was a control mechanism for him.
Some of the things that you've listed there in terms of time committed to the church, being closer to, or even, you know, within the entire community, the money coming into the church, is this some of the stuff that would go into those expectations that would give you those rewards that you would end up relying on so much as a member of the church?
Well, yeah, that's good. It's the money, the way that your money might continue the reward system would be either for appreciation expressed by the church for your continued participation. Although really in a couple of years, it felt more like a bill to be paid. But that would be one way. And then the other way would be when those funds were spent on the congregation, they were spent on pastors' favorite people and groups of the congregation. So if you were a golfer, which I wasn't, but you would golf for free and you would have a better life because the money that went to the pastor would be spent on you. And as time went on, it became more overt to where even some of the families, some of the members might be upstairs eating macaroni and cheese or ramen, you know, or hamburger helper or something like that. Whereas downstairs, the pastor and his friends would be ordering out really nice Szechuan or something. And it started to become a sense of favoritism, which isn't really anybody's big concern, except it was fueled by my money and by the the funds of these controlled cult members.
Were the messages from the pastor in terms of being humble and not having an ego, and there's no sense of competition, and then almost him nurturing that exact environment so that you will want to bring in more money at the detriment of your perhaps family's food intake for the week?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he as a narcissist, he had no concern for the physical welfare of anybody's family or anything. And it's not that we were starving. We were all working and, you know, we were okay in that. But there was no sensitivity or concern for bills and issues like that. He would claim he would claim to be the most humble person in the church, certainly, because he was most aware of his deep need for Christ. Now, what that meant was, I'm the most humble because I'm doing the worst things in the church and I'm getting away with it. And that means I must feel bad for it, right? So I'm pretty humble. I don't think he really felt bad for it, though. But nonetheless, that was used as if that were some kind of a mark of humility. But a big value in the church, and I think this contributes to what you're saying, Casey, is the saying was, "Are you fat?" F-A-T. And what that stood for, and as an acronym, was faithful, available, and teachable. Are you fat? And to be a disciple means you'll be fat, and you should care that you're fat, and on and on and on. So faithful meant, are you consistently trusting in God for your life and your needs and applying yourself to following God? You're faithful, you know, you could be a faithful gardener. That means you go out and you do your gardening. So are you faithful in regards to the Christian faith? Available. Do you reorder your life and schedule so that you are participating in the life of Christianity? That means you don't join a soccer club. We call it soccer here, sorry. A football club. You don't join a football club on Sunday mornings because you're in church on Sunday mornings and available. And the pastor has a prayer meeting on Monday mornings at 6 before everybody goes to work. Are you available? Will you wake up early and come to the prayer meeting? And on and on and on. Okay, so are you faithful? Are you available? And then finally, are you teachable? Are you not simply open to learning new information, but are you desirous of learning more and hungry to learn more about God from the Bible? Okay. Now that's the walk in the door explanation. Okay. Here's what it really means, though. Faithful is, are you wholly and solely committed to this church above your marriage, your family, your job, everything else in life? Can we count on you? Available. Will you put your job on the side, which I did? Will you put family, everything else on the side, aside? And will you wholeheartedly and unreservedly always be available to do what we want you to do? Come to a Bible study, come to a prayer meeting, work on our house, help set up chairs for church. Are you available? Do you always say yes, basically? And then finally, teachable. And this is really the devious one. Are you willing, you will make the mental contract that truth in your life only comes from us? If it does not come from us or through us, you will not receive it as truth. Of course, America is ready to fall apart now because of its struggle with truth, right? So in the church, teachable meant you will only receive truth from us. So if one of the pastors, I remember one of the pastors once just casually said that the Republican Party represented Christianity better than the Democrats and was more Christian than the Democrats. And that's not true. That's not true at all. But you couldn't argue with it and be teachable. So you would receive that as truth, but it's not true. And that's the kind of a mental contract that a cult member signs, that I will only receive truth from you. That's why when you meet with your friend, your sister, your whatever, who's in a cult, and you're thinking, good grief, we're going to have a cup of coffee here, and I sure hope I get a chance to just let him know that I think what his pastor says is really wackadoodle, man. It's really not right. And I hope I can say that. What you need to understand, and you probably won't get anywhere, is that if he's a cult member in good standing, he has made a mental contract that if it comes from you and it's not coming from him, it's not truth. And that's so those are the dark applications of faithful, available, teachable. You see what they said it meant, and then what it really meant in practice had nothing to do with Jesus, nothing to do with the Bible, nothing to do with even the Christian faith. It had all to do with the internetworking relationship to the pastor within the cult.
Was there an element in your 12 years of the Bible being used in a manipulative way to further the agenda of leadership, or was that something that you didn't have as much experience with?
At the time, since I was receiving it as truth, I just felt like, well, I'm hearing the word of God right here. Women cannot speak and cannot be pastors. Of course that hasn't worked out so well, and I don't believe that anymore, but I received that as truth because the Bible was presented as demanding that. And it's only when I got more of an education and thought about it myself for a few years that I felt like I could tear that apart quite easily through studying my Bible without that, you know, kind of control. So that's one area where the Bible was abused. The other one was in the area of supporting authority. King David was preached on a lot. And because he's a flawed leader, a severely flawed leader with a horrible family and problems that he probably took to the grave. And so as a concept of a leader who sins and yet is still an anointed leader to be obeyed and followed, he was pretty popular stuff to preach on in the church. And his story and narrative was used to justify the brutality and the autocracy of our leader in the church.
What point during your 12 years would you say you and Sharon moved in with to the communal home?
We joined it in 1984, and we moved into a communal home in 1989. Okay. And that was after selling a couple of homes to move in closer and closer to the church. So it was in 1989 that we did that. And there were probably 50 people in the church, a good number of children. And that's when we moved in.
You're in this group for a remaining 7 years. You remain living in this communal environment, or do things change before you and Sharon make the decision to leave the church altogether?
Things didn't change, except that they got worse. Once we moved in to the communal environment, and this kind of happened over a period of about a year of us renting these huge, beautiful homes on a mountain overlooking the city. So we're not exactly a struggling, urban, little, poor church anymore. We're spending money to rent, which is, you know, these big houses. And things started going downhill really fast because, as with most narcissistic leaders, they reach a point where they can't stop. they can't stop dominating, and they can't be nice to people because they perceive that as loss and weakening. So when we moved into the house, we began experiencing more rules about when we'd be able to make noise in the house, when we wouldn't, the volume of the TV, the rooms that had to be perfectly cleaned, the food we would eat. It just became a real controlling environment. And we would, of course, break away and get away when we could, my wife and I. But we didn't really. It's interesting. I was ready to leave about within 3 years of moving into the house. It was a couple of years later that my wife came around to it. These kinds of leaders destroy human relationships, and they cannot abide a healthy dyadic relationship that they're not the number two, the other person in it. So marriages, friendships, even kids that are best buddies or best friends cannot be left unmolested by these kinds of leaders. So our marriage really was on the rocks, or getting close to the rocks, when we moved into this situation. And then within the next 3 or 4 years, it just devolved with fighting and anger and suspicion of one another, and basically trying to disciple each other. Now you can imagine how much of a nice marriage that would create, right? So, and then it's kind of funny, when I would cause trouble or whatever with the pastor, that would affect Sharon's relationship with the pastor, because now her husband is this stubborn guy or something.
Nepotism.
Yeah, and vice versa. So we were so alienated from one another that it wasn't until 1996 that we were both getting back together on the same page, and we got pregnant with our third. So that kind of made us have to go, well, we better get along here. And we both finally were at a point where we'd come to the end of belief in the church. The contract was broken. It had been broken years earlier with me, and it was finally broken with Sharon. And we got to a point over really just a few months in 1996 where we both knew we were ready to leave and started looking for opportunities of escape. And by that, I don't mean we would be physically held or anything like that. I mean, we came and went as we want. But what I mean is the economic resources, the plan of where we would go live. I mean, we had no credit. We had very few possessions. And so we started putting together our plan, and then we walked out in 1996.
The aspect of your children and their friendships and everybody they've ever known and everybody that they've grown up in as being second generation members of the church, having to think about what that would mean for your children moving out of this church as well. Interesting what you mentioned about how things really started to go downhill after you moved into the home, in tangent with what you mentioned earlier about burning those bridges and closing people off, and how the love bombing and the positivity really would start to change to the reward and punishment system after all of those bridges were burnt. And then likewise, you move into the area and then you move into one of the communal homes. And then once you're closed off from everything, not just relationships and friendships, but also everything else, that's when it really becomes a diabolical environment.
Yes.
Just again, think that's interesting how you can pull those two things together and see how it's the same systems at work, but just on different levels.
That is the end of part one of this mini-series on surviving spiritual abuse. In part two, we focus on Ken's experiences specifically, with part three looking at Ken's escape, recovery, activism, and holding on to faith. For a link to Ken's work, please follow the link in the episode description. To get in touch with me, you can find me at cultvaultpodcast@gmail.com or follow me on Twitter and Instagram @cultvaultpod. I'm your speaker, Casey, host of the Cult Vault Podcast.